Hello, I'm Tyler Brulé, and welcome to the brand new season of The Big Interview here on Monocle 24. My guest today is a businessman, a concert pianist, an agony uncle, and a self-described committed capitalist. He's also a co-columnist of mine at the Financial Times. Having set up restaurants, members' clubs, and department stores across Asia, he's also dabbled in the cigar industry and has sat on countless boards for businesses, art institutes, and charities. Sir David Tang was born in Hong Kong in 1954 and moved to the UK at the age of 13 without a word of English, but went on to study at King's College here in London. His latest venture, Tang 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 Tang, is a lifestyle concept store aimed at the fastest growing middle class the world has ever seen. In China. Funny, thoughtful, but always a little bit outspoken, I'm delighted to say that Sir David Tang joins me right here in studio at Midori House in London. David, very nice to see you here in Studio 2. We're sometimes, well, not in the same section, but different sections of the Financial Times. We must cross over Russia or Chinese airspace quite frequently. And I often sort of think about David Tang in this world, in a post-Brexit world, the rise of many things in Asia, not all things in Asia. And I sometimes think Englishman or Chinaman or great that you can be a melange of the two.
I don't think of it as nationalities. I think there are many more similarities between nations and races than there are differences. And we're all human beings, and we're all greedy, we're all nasty, and we're all sometimes nice. And we usually think the same things, and we want to do the same things over and over again. Sex is an example. And it doesn't really matter whether you come from Africa or the Antarctica. Except in the Falklands, for example, you might have a bit more incest. But I think that the human species is more or less the same. And civilization is just another word for describing people in different sort of clothes.
Mm. Do you think that there's too much pressure on the whole notion of nice? So whether you write for a newspaper or whether you are managing a business, large or small, there are more HR codes in place which demand niceness in the workplace. When many would agree that we can be sort of a grumpy, unpleasant lot most of the time.
Well, the first thing to say about the word nice is that its accurate meaning, as you probably know, is subtle rather than anything denoting pleasant. And when you say someone is a nice person, I like to think that that person is a subtle person. Now, a man of subtlety does not necessarily have to be good-mannered, nor necessarily bad-tempered. I live a life in which I like to say exactly what I want to say, and I think the world has gone a bit mad over political correctness, and the one thing wrong with that is that it kills off a great deal of humor. And I think humor is probably the most precious commodity in our lives. Without humor, there is nothing. And I also think that the greater sense of humor you have, the greater perspective you have of life. If you think you're a comedian who paints an absurd picture and come up with ridiculous ideas, that is the man who can seize the extremities of a spectrum. And I like that as a principle, that you are not insulated within the band and that you should see the outer limits. I mean, I love the quote of George Bernard Shaw, who said, "The reasonable man is the man who wants to adapt to the world. The unreasonable man is the man who wants the world to adapt to him. Therefore, only the unreasonable man can change the world." And frankly, I don't want to be a reasonable man who doesn't change the world. I want the world to be changed. So if I'm an unreasonable man, I think that's quite nice. Whether it means my being having to be brutally truthful and offensive, or particularly pleasant when I feel I need to be sensitive.
How did we arrive in this odd, over PC place suddenly, and one that, I mean, really pervades, you know, every aspect of life? What are the forces?
I tell you, my humble theory is that there was a reaction to imperialism when people thought that the enslavement of nations and peoples is now totally unacceptable, and most of them conflate perhaps slavery with colonization. Now, I don't agree with everything about colonization or empire building, but I remind people that some of the greatest achievements and some of the most beautiful things built was the result of all these amazing things, just as, you know, the Roman Empire was pretty corrupt, but look at the kind of buildings they built during the Renaissance and etc. Now, the point is that now there's a generation of people who believe that we've got to go and pay some sort of punishment of having enslaved people and being particularly nasty to people, when in fact that's only one aspect of things. And so we've got this idea of an egalitarian world where everybody should be equal. Nothing wrong with that. But the only problem with that is that people seem to forget those ideals were the basis of communism and socialism and tyrannies, which actually have probably killed more people in the last century than the two world wars. You only have to think about Stalin and Mao. Between them, they probably killed 100 million people. Now, the point is that when you go over that, when you have revisionism of that type, that's when you want to be extra nice back to the people whom you think you have been rather, you know, awful too. And that's where you get it wrong, I think, because you go over, swing the other side of the pendulum. The sooner we realize this, the better.
I want to go back to your point about humor. This is something, of course, which media brands have to deal with. Where is the line? Should there be a line? Should we allow comment? Should there be a letters page? Things that, of course, you and I deal with a lot, you know, within the FT, certainly something we deal with in the magazine as well. This humor gene, do you think there's a danger that it'll cease being part of the genetic code at some point because so many people have lost it, or they feel that they have to quite literally sit on it?
Well, I don't know about your editor, but I mean...
Well, they wouldn't be here if they didn't have a sense of humor, so...
I get often a red light saying this has gone down to our lawyers. The point is...
Well, we think hooray at that point, right?
And you then bet that you were going to be censored. And I always try to fight the corner. And most of the time, publications, especially an institution like Financial Times, quite rightly, probably regard itself as being extremely correct. And therefore, they don't want to have anything provocative or salacious or not checked. And even if it was the truth, they sometimes don't want to confront another institution or people. And that's just an attitude of running a business, and a sensible one at that. And I don't bemoan that for that. But it is sometimes frustrating when you try to be humorous at the expense of, for example, being politically incorrect, and you get edited out. But then, you know, we have endless examples in history where the artistic has to give way to simple social etiquette dictated at the time.
We've been through an interesting summer here on, well, certainly in the UK, Europe in general. Just your view on the city we're sitting in right now. How does London feel to you? Have we been in this period of, well, did Brexit happen? Did not happen? Let's see where we are in September or October. Just the mood, because, you know, obviously this city very well, but you know many others perhaps even better.
My view is that outside of Britain, nobody gives a toss, mostly. My view is that Brexit has not brought about the chaos that a lot of Remainers predicted. And in fact, I read in the Financial Times that things are going quite well. Certainly, the Chancellor's threat before the referendum of imposing rather draconian emergency budget went straight out the window, even before he resigned. And many attitudes expected turn out to be very different. From day one, the governor of the Bank of England sounded much more conciliatory and, in fact, almost upbeat about the consequences of what might happen. And as we see, nothing has collapsed. And so life goes on. And I think is probably a good thing. I have two main objections to the EU. Number one, that it has had never had any rule of law. Under the Maastricht Treaty, it was specifically said that no country should be bailed out. And of course, we had Ireland, we had Portugal, we had Greece, we had, I mean, almost virtually every single country around the Mediterranean were bailed out. And then they had to change that law retrospectively. Now, I don't know whether people noticed, but I noticed, and a lot of other people noticed, and that for me is the loss of the rule of law. And secondly, I don't really understand how Britain, with its incredible richness and the provenance of legal sovereignty, could possibly allow some external force like the EU Commission or the Parliament to pass law that would override this great tradition of almost, 700 years of common law and statute law, which has made Britain probably the fairest and the most just country in the world, and that's absurd. So I'm delighted for Britain because, for another thing, Britain, whilst in the EU, was not able to negotiate any deal with the entire Commonwealth and her dominion. I mean, it's absurd that Britain couldn't buy lamb from New Zealand or beef from Canada except having to defer to the EU. That's stupid.
Let's jump to another city that you know well, Hong Kong, coming up to two decades on. When you touched down at the airport there, just your sense of the place as well. I mean, of course, everyone, we can rewind two decades and people can sort of talk about that all the wheels are going to fall off and there are various predictions. But does it have the snap and is it as good or is it
Is it
diminished?
It's a different place.
It's a different, no, absolutely. But I just...
It's a different place now because we are a population of 7 million people in Hong Kong and 48 million mainlanders come through Hong Kong every year, rising. So this year we're going to have over 50 million, seven times as many of those of us who live there. It's my home, and just as Churchill said that democracy is the worst kind of government, except for all the other kinds of which have been tried, I think Hong Kong is the worst city in the world, except that I've tried other cities around the region. And I think that we should be lucky that the place still is relatively uncorrupt and it's got rule of law and it is incredibly free. And I think that the only edge it has lost is the excitement of the juxtaposition that East-West played a central role before, because you always get interesting things happening when you have the interaction of two different cultures, whereas now is mono, is one-dimensional or one-and-a-half-dimensional because the 50 million mainlanders more or less dictate what we do. If you go to the supermarket, you could find that the shelf is completely depleted of milk because people come over and scoop up everything to go across the border to sell it at a premium because people across the border don't trust the milk in China. As simple as that. And so if you're living in a normal block and you go down to get a carton of milk and you find that there's absolutely never any wretched milk on the shelf. And of course, you know, people have to buy property at an extortionate price as so much money is laundered within Hong Kong for the mainlanders to go and acquire this property and not being the end user. So there are many, many flats which are completely empty, but they're not available. And so, you know, even our soap opera now has got Chinese subtitles because we speak Cantonese and people can't understand Cantonese. And so our soap opera, like the Coronation Street equivalent, would carry Chinese subtitles that are understood by mainlanders. And everything is now, the retail business is entirely dependent upon people coming in and tipping on the table a suitcase of cash. It's wonderful. And, you know, I sometimes laugh about it, but I now regard Hong Kong as one big Chinese laundry, the biggest Chinese laundry in the world, and it enriches people and it keeps Hong Kong going. So I'm not particularly moaning. There are some very generous mainlanders and there are some complete shits. So, you know, there it is. Which other place hasn't got both kinds of people?
Well, why don't we do a little, let's play a little game. You talked about other cities in the region. I'm going to give you a name of a city and then you just give me your sort of first reaction. So why don't I say Seoul?
Well, Seoul is the one city that hasn't got it. It's soulless. The problem with Korea is that in South Korea, kimchi rules the roost. Everywhere you go, you have kimchi. And it's so tiresome that everywhere you go, you have this wretched thing lurking in the corner. The only thing good about Korea, I think, is their innovation in creating the worst possible design cars that are actually bought by a lot of people. And I don't know how they get away with it. I wouldn't go to Seoul if I was an exiled. And I think North Korea is a bit more interesting. I've been to North Korea a couple of times, and that's a very funny country. I mean, it's very full of freaks. It is extraordinary how you can jog around in the city. I know you jog around everywhere. I don't know whether you've jogged in Punyong, but it is entirely empty. It's like a scene out of On the Beach. You know, the world has gone into a nuclear meltdown and the only place left is Punyong and you are the only other person. And then when you start running, you live in a completely different world. It's Blade Runner, except it's empty.
Why don't we jump, we'll stick close to Hong Kong, Taipei.
Taipei is so excruciatingly lacking in style. I have never met a Taiwanese. I've never seen an apartment or a house or a shed or a shop or a restaurant that is actually decorated with style. It is, in fact, the most extraordinary city in the world where nothing elegant and stylish is ever achieved. And the only good thing about Taipei is when your plane takes off and you see the city drawing away from you. And there is one good thing about Taipei, two good things about Taipei or Taiwan on the whole. Number one is that their beef noodle is damn good. I have to give them that. I don't know where they kill all the cows, but I mean, the stock is always extremely good wherever you go. And the second thing is that they do have a sense of Chinese history. So the whole culture of Chinese is still very much maintained. And of course, they write the classical script still, different from what is used in the mainland. And so there's a great deal of scholarship. So good scholars in Taiwan are extremely precious people. They are the people who are going to perpetuate Confucianism. They are the people who are going to perpetuate classical learning and so forth. And there is, in the educational system, a very rigorous syllabus still pertaining to understanding Chinese history as from the mainland, because it is detached from it. And, you know, you always get the same as that local ginger is never as good as abroad. So somehow Taiwan, as the abroad bit, has got that hotter ginger and that hotter appetite for Chinese history. And it's a very clever city, because if you think about it, the Silicon Valley was built because of the chip industry in Taiwan. And at the time, Taiwan had the second biggest reserves of foreign currency in the world in the 70s and 80s.
We've taken off from Taipei Taoyuan Airport. The captain comes on. You thought you were heading back to Hong Kong, but as if for whatever reason, we're diverting. We're going quite far. So we're diverting to Singapore. What do you do?
Well, I would try to stay on the plane before it takes off. But if I had to get off, I would know that I have to suffer that monotonous 32 degrees heat. And it's not surprising that the Tiger Balm comes from Singapore, because that is the ointment that is good for about everything. You know, if you're vomiting, or if you've got a sore throat, if you've got a sore finger, you've got anything, it's very good. But it's not good about anything. And that's the problem. And so, you know, Singapore is one big Tiger Balm ointment. And the way Lee Kuan Yew boasts about his success is ridiculous in a way, because, of course, his nation, when he ruled it, had only 2 million people. You can't extrapolate a tiny city like that or a country like that with 2 million people and expect that other nations with 60 million or 50 million or a proper country could possibly have the same effect. And I simply can't stand the fact that it is didactic approach, and I don't want the government to interfere. Of course, they still allow people to chew gums and have hair longer than an ape, but at one time they didn't. I mean, all these repressive things. And worst of all, everybody eats at 7 o'clock and they go home at 9:30. After that, there's absolutely nothing. They got rid of Boogie Street. They now have a street which has got legalized prostitution. I went down the other day. I have never seen such ugly wear in the whole world. I mean, there's just the most appalling kind of prostitutes. And that tells you something about Singapore, that even in the area of vice, is ugly. And the hypocrisy by readmitting or doing a U-turn on its casino and promoting gambling because of money, that really takes the biscuit. And even worse now, they built this enormous casino, which I'm sure you've seen, which has got a swimming pool that straddles the top five floors, so you can swim across. I just hope one day the middle bit would collapse, and while somebody's swimming, they would just fall straight through 48 floors. That would be very amusing.
Mr. Tang, you don't have to get off the aircraft, because this plane now is, we're taking it to Tokyo.
Ah, now you're talking. That is the center of a refinement. Japan is the most extraordinary city. When my children finished their schools in Hong Kong, I said to them, do you want to go to England and do your A-levels? And they said, yes. And I said, well, how about if I send you to Japan? And they said, well, we don't mind. So they went for 2 years in Japan, because I said that they would never, ever encounter a country or a culture as extraordinary as Japan. And they agreed. And I'm so glad they went, and they love it. I love it, because there is something extraordinary about the Japanese. They got the filthiest mind in the world. I mean, pornography excels in Japan to an extent that makes Hollywood's invention seem like sort of Walt Disney kindergarten stuff. But what is extraordinary about that country is the sense of pride and is the sense of serenity and the artistry each vernacular person sees as being incredibly beautiful, and the way in which they make their food look like art itself, and that they have a sense of duty. The entire Japanese railway system loses 4 seconds in a year. I mean, tell that to Richard Branson, okay? I mean, 4 seconds. Everything runs like clockwork. You know exactly what is going to happen. And then when you see the beauty of the blossoms and the way everybody behaves, I love Japan and I love Tokyo, and the food is absolutely divine, and I would live in Japan any day if I could.
Do Beijing and Tokyo ever find their way to each other, do you think?
The Chinese hate the Japanese. They remember Nanjing. They remember everything that the Japanese tried to emulate the Chinese. They've always regarded Japan as the aggressive force who wants to dominate and take over China. So I think in the next generation or two, that innate hatred will remain, and there is no trust between the two. And similarly, Japan is frustrated by the fact that it has not managed and succeed to conquer that country, which has always been the prize of what it wants.
Just before we go, before we went on air, you were heading to the Baltics to go after a couple of birds, the flying kind. Where would you like to spend the rest of your days? You talked about, you know, you had to go into exile. We're going to give you one last destination. Where would you put your feet up?
I would say I wouldn't mind going to Scotland somewhere, because it is a crazy country. It has got some extraordinary characters. I wouldn't mind, however, retiring at the Hartford Club, because it is so beautiful, and I can just walk across to the Curzon Cinema and watch a film every day. That would please me enough. And I go back to the Harvard Club, where there are many books on the shelf still to be read. And that's all I really want to do. And in Scotland, in a way, you know, I'm not a physical type, but I am persuaded by the extraordinary scenery, the nature, where you really feel the force of something beyond and something beautiful. Scotland has an enormous history of bravery, heroism, romance, and a great mercantile history outside of Scotland, for example. And so they are very resilient people. And the only thing is, if I did that, I will have to arrange a whole crate of instant noodles to be dropped wherever I am every year, because I can't stand the sight and the thought of eating haggis or anything ghastly that most of the Scots eat all the time.
David Tang, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Tyler Brulé, in conversation with Sir David Tang. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luthi, researched by Guy Lutz, and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, all that's left is to say goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.